from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, New York Times columnist Mark Bittman is currently a visiting fellow at UC Berkeley's Food Institute. We'll talk to the How to Cook Everything author about his new book, A Bone to Pick, and about the high quality of California produce and a whole range of food issues, including, as he sees it, the need to reinvent the nation's food system. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. The last time Mark Bittman was here with us, he was talking about VB6, his book on the pursuit of a part-time vegan diet. And the food policy and cooking op-ed columnist for the New York Times is also the author of How to Cook Everything and is currently a visiting fellow at UC Berkeley's Food Institute, as well as author of a new book, A Bone to Pick, the good news about food with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more. He joins us for the second hour. Welcome back to Forum. Good morning.
Great to be here, Michael.
Let's start with something really positive. You are a strong convert to Meyer Lemons, but also to California produce.
Yes.
I mean, you're raving about California produce, and that's good for Californians to hear, but also raving about some local places like the Monterey Market and Cook's Heaven, and the fact that there are four farmers markets right where you're living now in Berkeley. So let's talk about produce first. But what I was struck by was that you said you never had more fun cooking, even grilling onions and asparagus, than you had here in the Bay Area.
Well, you know, the Bay Area is deceptive, and it's very tricky. I'm probably not going to give you a simple and raving an answer as you would like. I mean, obviously you can get or perhaps not obviously, but you can get the best ingredients you can get anywhere, which is really quite a thing to say. The most beautiful produce and a very long growing season and a shocking number of things in fine shape in the middle of the winter.
And a drought that's now afflicting us.
And a drought and a two-hour drive to some of the most egregious industrial agriculture anywhere on the face of the earth. So it's a really mixed bag and a total fun as a journalist, because you can have positive conversations about how wonderful the Meyer lemons are, or you can, you know, talk about dairy farms that probably shouldn't – mega dairy farms that probably shouldn't exist. And you have everything in between here.
Well, I wanted to also talk with you about we'll get into a lot of issues. But I was thinking this morning about food labeling, because you write a lot about it in your new book and you have written a lot about it. Is it really necessary for produce? I mean, and I ask that question advisedly because I think, you know, with antibiotics and things, it may be more necessary for meat. But produce is kind of a marketing standard. It's developed as a consensus of stakeholders, and it's voluntary. And is it different than mandatory labeling based on the need to avoid a certain type of food because it's unsafe with produce?
I think the only label that really – no, well, that's not true. The only label you can put on produce that matters right now is whether it's organic or not, and that does matter. I'd like to see labeling. You know, one of the first things I did when I started the opinion column was did my dream food label, which was a complete fantasy. But, you know, I've said I'd like to see labeling that let us know how the workers who produced that food were treated. And that certainly is an issue with produce, where you have in California alone something like a million migrant workers who work seasonally, who work mostly for $9 or $10 an hour, and who are living below the poverty level. And without those people, you don't get to eat fruits and vegetables. So I'd like those people to be treated. I'd be happier if those people were treated better. And
it's become a big issue for you now, labor, really.
Well, it's not. It's been a big issue for me for 40 years. But I think I just made the connection between writing about food and writing about working conditions 4 or 5 years ago. The fact that Walmart came out with these new voluntary and really not bad but vague standards for animal welfare last week, but is well known as a corporation that mistreats its workers, is just completely horrifying to me.
Well, you also have taken an attack about – we'll get back maybe to some labeling issues – but about minimum wage and organizing and have been rather strong and advocate, supporter, whatever you want to say about something like the coal campaign that the Sierra Club is doing, yeah?
I was impressed with the Sierra Club campaign because they set out to do something and they're doing it.
Talk about that. We may have defined it for listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Well, it's called Beyond Coal, and they said we're gonna try to make it so there's no coal in the United States by 2030. And they've closed something like 150 coal plants, and they've stopped something like 150 others from opening. So actually the numbers are better than that, but I'm being conservative because I can't remember exactly what they are. But that's an impressive campaign. That's a campaign that says we see something that's wrong and we're going to work to fix it. And the fact that they've actually gotten results is really impressive.
Sounds like you want results, though. You want to kind of reinvent the food system. And you were talking about some of your fantasies before. I want to get to some more of those. But concentrating on candidates, on how they stand on food, on particular priorities, maybe even a kind of triage like restricting the use of antibiotics or eliminating concentrated animal feeding that's going on. A lot of these have become major to you, and it seems to me you're saying, well, I'm a food columnist, but I'd really like to see some grassroots organizing here and people making candidates answerable.
Well, they're not being a food columnist and making candidates answerable or advocating for organizing is certainly not
They're not mutually exclusive. No, I didn't mean to suggest this, but you kind of downplay the fact that you're not necessarily going to be out there organizing or on the hustings.
Well, that might not play well, but you know the other thing is I'm busy and I'm old, and I think my role is as a propagandist, if that's the right word, or an advocate. I did my time knocking on doors, and I did my time community organizing, and it was 40 years ago. I'll do what I can to support other people doing it now.
Well, you're doing a lot in your column. And in fact, we should mention you're doing something here locally. I'm actually looking at Mark Bittman, California Matters, set to air from May 11th. Tell us about
June 8th, actually, now.
yeah, I thought has been airing and it's not to our knowledge. No. By the way, there's a trailer about this on our website and there's something embedded on it and more information about the actual date and all that.
Well, thank you for putting it up there. So, yes, California Matters is launching June 8th. And when I got here, my role at UC Berkeley was, let's say, vague. But everybody was, including me, was very excited to be here, that I was here. But I wanted to do something that would guarantee that I got out and about in the state. So I pitched a little video series, which turned into a much bigger video series, in which I travel around the state and talk to people in the university system, the Cal system, about interesting things they're doing in food. And some of them are lighter and more amusing. We did a segment on two guys in Berkeley who have become expert in gathering edible weeds and putting them out in the marketplace and showing people how to forage. And that's an incredible – that'll probably be our launch spot. And that's an incredible spot because I actually happened to have dinner with one of the guys last night. And the number of edible weeds that are out on the sidewalks is just incredible. Just incredible. And if you go up into, you know, the Berkeley Hills, the Oakland Hills, you can't believe what there is. Once you know what to look for, you can't believe how much of it there is. But so the range of topics is from that to stuff that's much heavier, like, to get back to labor issues, like the use of pesticides in fields in Salinas and how that affects maternal and neonatal health. Which is, you know, just a huge issue. And sort of everything in between, many things in between.
Some new information in this series about California's changing food production and agriculture?
Well, it'll be new to people who don't know it. There's nothing I don't think there are any scoops, but I found it. I found what we were doing fascinating, and I think the presentation's really good. And a lot of it is, you know, academics are not, you know this as well as I do. As a journalist, we have a funny. As journalists, we have a funny relationship with academics because they're annoyed to some extent that we get the information that they've worked so hard to gather out to the public. But at the same time, they need us because their communication skills are, let's say, not
careful. You're talking to someone who is an academic as well as a journalist.
Oh, yeah, but you're going to agree with this anyway. In general, journalists are better communicators than academics. So I think a lot of this information should be out there, and it hasn't been out there. And I think that the, you know, the California Matters series is going to get some of it out there. Whether it's groundbreaking or not is not as important as whether it's valuable or not, and it is valuable.
Well, again, you can see a trailer on this and find more information on our website, kqed.org/forum. And a reminder, we're talking with New York Times op-ed writer Mark Bittman, columnist for The New York Times. His new book is A Bone to Pick, The Good and Bad News About Food, with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more. And there's a lot in this book. I was actually reading an article in Forbes where they describe you as a foodie version of a warmonger.
I love that.
I know you don't like the word foodie, but that was their word. But the kind of the pith of the article was that maybe – I mean, you're bringing up things that are very dear to many of the listeners of this program, concern about climate change and obesity and what we eat and the effect it has on those, or what's being done to the environment and animals and so forth. We go on and on. I'm interested, though, in what results we've seen from the advocacy that you have – and many who are right behind you and your troops, let's say, to use that battle metaphor, have stood for. I mean, when we have – when we see soda taxes, for example, and we see the very small reduction in terms of obesity, it's demoralizing.
This is a very young movement, and these are really new concepts to many of us. I don't know what to expect when. I don't know whether to be. I am hopeful, but I don't know when you register successes and when you don't. I think you bring up soda tax, and I think the best example of a soda tax, which I had almost nothing to do with, even in terms of supporting and barely in terms of writing about, is not Berkeley's but Mexico's, which is a national soda tax and which resulted in its first year in a decline in the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages by 10% and an increase in the consumption of water by 12%. So that is a measurable success, I think. Berkeley, you know, Berkeley's a small city. When there's a soda tax in Philadelphia or Chicago or someplace like that, that'll be serious business. We have the attention of some people. You know, I mentioned these new Walmart standards. McDonald's has pledged to get rid of antibiotics in its chicken products.
Does that make you more kindly disposed to McDonald's?
No, because these people promise things, and they promise them 5 years down the road, and they've promised things before, and they don't deliver. But at least it shows that they're responding to pressure to some. You know, everything Walmart, McDonald's, and so on, many of the things that they've done – and there are corporations that have behaved better – but many of the things that the most egregious corporations have done have been the equivalent of greenwashing. But at least – they feel obligated to do that, which 5 years ago, you know, McDonald's gave a dollar an hour raise to 90,000 employees. That really stinks, but it's better than nothing.
What do you say to those who come down on things like soda tax, but also a lot of – I mean, I notice you know, you're talking about having lawns turned to vegetable gardens, things that seem a bit like pie in the sky, you know, or pipe dreaming, free cookware and cooking classes for poor people, or even soda machines turned into vending machines that give grapes and carrots.
You've seen that. We've seen that. I can show you those vending machines.
All of those come under a kind of category in many people's minds, though, of the nanny state and interfering with free will. Marion Nestle and people who have been on this program have been taken on that whole topic. You know, you're trying to use the government to solve problems that really infringe on people's free will. And you say what to that?
Well, free. No one's forcing you to use any vending machine at all. I don't know what example you want to use here, but government's job is to the market is not concerned with public health, and I think we see that all the time. The market is not concerned whether workers are treated well. We see that all the time. Government means to govern means to steer. We need guidance in order to live good lives. And in fact, people need protection. Many people need protection from what I see as the ravages of big business. So who's going to provide that protection? Where do you look? That has nothing to do with free will. My free will, if I'm working as a farm laborer and getting $9 an hour, my free will is not going to get me health care or $12 an hour or $18 an hour. My free will has nothing to do with that. I need protection.
Protection to what extent, though? I guess I would.
Well, what's minimum?
Well, no. When we're talking about labor issues, we're talking about maybe a different category, minimum wage and that sort of thing. I'm thinking more of the right to choose to eat what you want to eat.
Okay, then let's take a different example. Sorry to interrupt.
To right to eat junk if you want to eat junk at McDonald's or whatever.
So a 2-year-old has, in this estimation, a 2-year-old can exercise his or her free will.
It's a different category too. Underage. I mean, we're talking about protecting delinquents.
But they're being marketed to. How is that a different category? So, well, how do you restrict that marketing?
Well, there are those who would object to that. I wouldn't necessarily object to that. But when you're talking about adults making decisions as adults.
Well, adults can use whatever vending machine they want to use. I'm saying make vending machines with vegetables in it. Those are not available to adults right now. Then they can use their free will to buy a soda or a carrot. I don't care. Then it's free will. I don't see – you're like – asking a question and then broadly eliminating categories of the answer.
No, I'm asking how much do you push the idea of government regulation? We had Charles Murray on, for example. A lot of people took exception, but I was glad we had his point of view, which is simply there's too much regulation. There has to be civil disobedience against regulation and so forth. That's taking it to an extreme.
Well, that's moronic. I'm sorry. I mean, if he was here, I'd tell him it was moronic. I think the best example is you are allowing marketers – to target 2-year-olds with sugar-sweetened beverages. That can't be. These are not rational human beings. Even 14-year-olds should be protected against the ravages of marketing. And that you can't say this is a matter of free will because we restrict what children do all the time. We tell children what to do all the time. We make them go to school. We don't let them vote. We don't let them buy cigarettes. When something is known to be dangerous to young people, we try to restrict it.
Absolutely. So, no disagreement. But right. With adults, we're talking about adults now and their right to
– Well, we tax cigarettes. We tax alcohol. We restrict their sale. This is not that different.
No more nanny state in your judgment of controlling what adults eat or what corporations do.
Means. I want government to protect public health. I mean, nanny state means building roads. Nanny state means building sewers. I mean, there are public health challenges. There are infrastructure challenges that we rely on the state to do. This is protecting us from something that's harmful.
What do we do about bad diets then? Let me actually go to another subject that you frequently go to, and that is fad diets, because they're bad from your perspective, aren't they?
Well, they're not helpful, I would say. I mean, bad is extreme in this case. But, it's not helpful to say eat only this or never eat that. And I think the current darling of the diet world is gluten-free. And there's really no evidence that unless you're gluten intolerant or have celiac disease, which is a very small percentage of the population, that gluten is a problem for people. Now,
it's become a big problem for many people, though. I mean, in fact,
it's become a great marketing opportunity for many people also.
I love the title of a book called Scared Wheatless. I don't know if you've seen that. And there are people who just they think that it's there in a category with sugar and all these other things.
Well, there are people looking for magic bullets. That's how we've grown up. We've grown up to think that there are simple fixes for everything, but there aren't. Some things are a little more complicated.
And as far as the minimum wage, what are we talking about, $15?
What do I think the minimum wage should be?
It would be higher than that.
Well, I think $15 is the fact that Los Angeles and again, it's being phased in over 5 years, so it's not really as abrupt as all that. But let's say Los Angeles is raising its minimum wage $1 a year between now and 2020. Let's look at it in 2020. Maybe it should continue to go up $1 a year after that.
Let me also ask you, because
I mean, people should be. Can we agree that people should be able to afford to pay rent and buy food?
Oh, of course. In fact, it's dreadful to think about what some of these CEOs are paid, and they're talking about not wanting minimum wage. But my opinions are far less important than yours in this context. Because
okay, then let me just express mine for 1 second here. It should be defined as something that provides some kind of standard of living that we would all be more or less comfortable with. I don't know what that is.
It's hard to define. It's hard to get a metric on.
It is hard to define.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you see things that say you would need $40 an hour to rent, you would need to be making the equivalent of $40 an hour to be able to rent a two-bedroom apartment in San Francisco, that says to me San Francisco is hostile to people who make less than $40
an hour. I think you need
hour.
More than that now in San Francisco.
Okay, but
the rents are going up.
But
even
the point
higher.
Is that the kind of city you want where everybody makes at least $50 an hour? Because if it is, that's what you're headed towards. I mean, where's your labor force? San Leandro? Okay, but how do they get here? And so on.
No, even beyond San Leandro. So Tracy, they have to come into town. You know, let's also talk, though, about you have represented in your columns here in this new book, and the new book, by the way, is called A Bone to Pick, so many different issues. One of them that I find particularly of concern, a lot of them I find of concern personally, but it's the idea how we encourage more small farming and how we get away from agribusiness. And your thoughts about that?
Well, it is a concern, and at the risk of you bringing up the nanny state issue again, I think we need government help here. And if you look at what happened in the United States after the Civil War, which is a period of time that no one alive remembers, but it's not all that long ago. The United States pledged to give 40 acres and a mule to anyone who wanted it, except, of course, to black people, to former slaves. So right from the get-go, farming was government involvement in farming was problematic, and it remains problematic. The government gave a lot of land to railroads. The government gave a lot of land to banks. And these things are echoing with us today. The question is, how do we fix these wrongs? How do we right these wrongs? And how do we get some kind of program that'll allow land to get into the hands of young people who want to farm? And not 5,000 acres at a time, but 50 and 100 acres at a time. Because if acreage is $10,000 and up, how do young people get into farming? I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think you're going to solve this with market forces. I don't think that's going to work.
Again, our guest is Mark Bittman, who is op-ed columnist for the New York Times, food writer for the New York Times, has a new book out called A Bone to Pick. And I'm going to invite those of you listening to join us. And by the way, we don't have to talk about – we are talking about obviously a lot of food issues, but there's other things that concern him in addition to the kind of big issues that we're talking about. Like I read a column you did recently about loving scraps. You went to a Washington, D.C. Japanese restaurant and suddenly were filled with all kinds of new, respect and love maybe for dorsal fins and arms and collars and things like that. Anyway, he's known particularly for recipes and for love of food and for many things within the whole culinary world. So feel free to join us with whatever's on your mind, and we invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's the number to call if you have something to add to the conversation, or if you have a question or comment, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Mark Bittman, whose new book is called A Bone to Pick, and talking about all matters having to do with food. And might be, before we go to calls and emails here, good to have you talk a bit about what it you've been experiencing the farmers markets now, and maybe some suggestions about what to cook with. Can we go to those?
The local farmers markets are such a joy because they're, there's one within a 5-minute walk of my house, and you have this ever changing selection of really, really nice stuff. But I was amazed a couple of weeks ago. I came into Ferry Plaza, on a Saturday morning. And I just thought, oh my God, I forgot this. There's just more energy in this place than there is anywhere. And it is so much fun. So I don't know. I shop and I look for stuff that looks unusual or terrific or exciting, and I go home and cook with it. I mean, there's not – I'm trying to write the series for the Times about what I'm cooking with while I'm here, and it just – everything gets simpler and simpler, and you begin to understand how something like Chez Panisse evolved into a place that, you know, treats food so minimally. And, you know, the whole concept of being we're going to take good ingredients and we're not going to mess with them much, you know, it didn't originate here because it's old and it's international. But from a food revival U.S. perspective, it really did start here.
And in fact, Peter Coyote was on last week and we were talking about Bud Trillin came up with this, or I'm not sure who came up with it initially, but they said the real revolution that came out of the 60s was Alice Waters and the food movement.
Well, it was one of them. I mean, you wouldn't discount feminism, for example, but yeah.
Some things on produce before we go to calls here. Maybe we can just go through these. Patrice says, I'm a devoted foodie and have been a vegetarian for 50 years. You don't like that word foodie, though, do you?
I'm trying to make it more respectable. It needs help.
Well, Patrice also says, I'm also an organic gardener in Fairfax, and what can we do about those horrid non-organic stickers that are all over the produce? Please help us get rid of the stickers. They are not always easy to remove, and they are not edible.
Agreed. I don't know what to do about that. Her solution is grow your own. That's probably as good a solution as you're going to get.
Just staying with produce for a moment, another listener writes, I'm happy and encouraged that Mr. Bittman is residing in our little corner of the world. I found some of my most delicious and enduring recipes from his New York Times minimalist column, especially those of the vegetable variety. He really has quite a touch with produce. And speaking of produce, I'm sure that he has made several tours of our region's legendary farmers markets, but I still must recommend that he check out the Heart of the City Farmers Market on Wednesdays at Civic Center Plaza if he hasn't already, while the Saturday market at the Ferry Building is the fancy schmancy spot. With more prepared food vendors than actual farmers, the Heart of the City is huge, has less name brand farms, but more ethnic, especially Asian vendors, and way better prices.
Okay, I can go there tomorrow. I'm going to be on – can I plug myself? I'm going to be on KCBS tomorrow, so I'll go over there after that.
Plug yourself on a competitor. It's okay. Yeah. Boris writes, which fruits and vegetables should only be purchased if grown organically? There's a list called the Dirty Dozen, which lists produce from peaches to spinach that should only be purchased if organic. Is it a valid approach to buying produce?
They're friends of mine. That list comes from Environmental Working Group, EWG, which is a great organization. But I don't think really the data exists to say these are the fruits and vegetables that are highest in pesticides and these are the fruits and vegetables that are lowest. And, you know, these days there are systemic pesticides, which is to say you're not going to do yourself any good if you peel that apple or even peel that banana. So, I have to go on for another 30 seconds here. I think it's important, critically important, that everybody, almost everybody, eat more fruits and vegetables than they are already doing. I mean, that's almost a universally true statement. And I think that's the first consideration. If you then have money and you then have time and you can buy organic vegetables, I think you're better off. But if you don't, you still need to eat more fruits and vegetables.
And we'll go to a caller, and that's you. Jack, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much. This is very refreshing. I'm glad to hear this your guest's opinion. My question is regarding farmers markets and organic. We've been eating organic for about 5 years now, exclusively, almost exclusively. There's a couple things we can't find. But my concern is when we go to the farmers market, we stopped doing this because we heard some things in the news about claimed organic and how they're perhaps not so organic. So we really trust the big box stores, the Whole Foods market, because they have the deep pockets and they could lose money if something proves that, you know, somebody's doing something not very, you know, not on the up and up. So how can we get better assurance about our about farmers markets to make people who really want organic and have a confidence in what they're buying?
Well, my understanding is that in California, all farmers markets are producers markets. Do you know if that's true, Michael? Which is to say you can't do a farmers market and sell bananas because no one's producing bananas in California. This could be wrong, but at least
– I don't know.
Okay. At least most farmers markets in California are producers markets. And I think in a way you have to trust producers, you have to get to know producers, and you have to make the – leap of faith to say these people are not trying to rip me off. There are fraud squads in every city or whatever who are trying to find those kinds of violations. But I think for the most part, you can assume that organic from producers is organic. I want to say another thing, which is that there's the letter of organic law and there's the spirit of organic. And if you are growing 3,000 acres of grapes, for example, and calling them organic, there are many, many ways in which those fields are. They may be organic according to the letter of the law, but they are not organic in the way that a really diverse organic farm is producing organic food.
Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller. Scott, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was thinking the other day about those victory gardens that came up during World War II, and I consider World War II to be a large market force in swaying that. But it also, they also had a, you know, a strong figurehead behind it. So I wondered not how to solve what our food problems are, but how to put a dent in the just the status quo of our overall system. And if someone like the Pope, I don't think he's got quite the charisma to do it, no offense to him, got up and said, listen, if you're a Catholic, I want, you know, grow as much food as you can and simply share as much food as you can. I just wonder what that might do to what ripples that might cause. And I think the danger that we run into is that we try to put a business model around something like that. And I don't even know if you can imagine a business model. And the second thing is that once we start to grow our own food and try to get it into restaurants, I think we might be strangled by regulations that we've imposed ourselves for our own protection. I just want to get your feedback on that.
So it's a complicated question, but 48% of the fruits and vegetables in the United States were grown in victory gardens during World War II. Half of our consumption was grown at home. So that's a pretty incredible thing. I think we have to be at this point happy with 5% and 10% incremental changes. I mean, I'd be very happy for the Pope to say exactly what you said. And certainly, you know, there are cities that restrict gardens in place of front lawns. Those kind of regulations need to change. We do need to encourage gardening as much as we can. And I think we'll see some of that. And as for the regulation stuff, I think you have to look at Uber, which really has taught many municipalities how to look at regulations in a new way and say, are these regulations really working the way we want them to work? Because like it or not, Uber's pretty creative and it has changed cities' ways of thinking about taxis and licensing and things like that. The same thing can happen with homegrown food in restaurants and in schools and so on.
Email from Leslie, who writes, Mark Bittman brings up agricultural labor right at the beginning, as should be. We need this voice. Labor challenges have been mostly ignored in the current hoopla about organic sustainability and eating local. But labor is at the very center of having a more responsible food supply and challenging Big Ag's power. It's also important to understand that producers of all levels and types need to address the problem of fair labor. These workers are essential to having something on our plate every day and are marginalized by intention, suffering terrible working conditions, including pay. Academia colludes with Big Ag to ignore this situation. We must change this, and I recommend a book, Labor and the Locavore by Margaret Gray, and the film Food Chains. Part of your food manifesto is breaking up the Department of Agriculture and maybe empowering to a greater degree FDA, but you've also cataloged in a very thoughtful way a lot of the failures of FDA. So how would they be more empowered to do the job that we would hope and expect them to do?
Well, I mean, the single most important – I'd like to address this not so much a question but her comment and
do that first. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, all you can do is try to support – you know, Jim Cochran, who runs Swanton Berry Farm down in Davenport, which is an odd little place on the way to Santa Cruz, does organic strawberries with union labor. He's the only person I know who does that. He's in many of the farmers' markets and needs to be supported for that.
And it's
quite
successful.
Grows great strawberries, by the way.
It's the most backbreaking work for laborers, I mean, in terms of, you know, campesinos and so forth.
Could well be.
Yeah.
You know, I think of course, I'll take this email home and put it up on my wall. I mean, this is exactly what people need to be saying. Animal welfare is all well and good. One would not argue against animal welfare, but we have brothers and sisters out there in the field breaking their backs for not enough, you know, for poverty wages, and that just shouldn't be. I mean, and as I said at the beginning, the food wouldn't be on our – we wouldn't be eating strawberries without that. We wouldn't be eating lettuce without that labor. So how can you put so cheap a price on it? It just shouldn't be. As for FDA, FDA has in its power a thing that could really change food in the United States, and that is the ability to say you will not use routine antibiotics in the raising of animals anymore. You will only use antibiotics when animals are sick. And FDA refuses to do that. So it's not even really a question of further empowering FDA. It's a question of FDA doing its job.
Getting some responses here by tweets. And by the way, you can tweet us. Our tweet handle is at KQED Forum. Palmer sends this in. Up to 50 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and the number one food trigger is gluten. Gluten-free is not a fad.
Okay.
He argues. Another listener says, is all organic food GMO-free, or can GMO food be organic? Seems like organic and non-GMO should be grown in connection with each other.
Organic is by definition non-GMO. I think that's the question, right?
I think that is the question. Yeah.
Yeah. By definition, no GMOs in organic food.
People like Bruce Ames, you know, who's a much venerated scientist, say that organic food is too expensive and it's not necessarily safer or healthier.
I think we need to move to different standards, but I think it's the best standard that we have right now. I would disagree with what he's saying, and it's certainly safer and healthier for farm workers if he's going to maintain that chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, etc., are safer for farm workers than organic versions of the same or even better, organic methods which may not use sprays at all. I think he's wrong.
Again, our guest is Mark Bittman. His new book is A Bone to Pick, and Carol has a recommendation for you. Carol writes, I strongly encourage Mark Bittman to have a good look at the urban composting program that Recology operates for the city of San Francisco. It is composting taken to enormous scale, and we must move cities toward this model. Please advocate for this. Backyard composting is good, but in San Francisco, the green bin program is mandatory and hugely successful. If Mr. Bittman had an organic wine with last night's dinner, it could have been made with what people in San Francisco scrape from their plates.
Drank scotch last night, as it happens. But I am a supporter, of course, of big-time composting. And one of the things I've said about the universe that the University of California ought to do is commit to buying huge amounts of maybe 50% or whatever of its food from local farmers, and then in return give those farmers compost from campuses, which seems like a system that ought to work.
Reasonable. We'll get another caller on. Frankie, you're on.
Yes, I wanted to say I'm very enthusiastic about your show today. I'm 100% allergic to all chemicals. I have been for years, so I have to eat 100% organic. I don't drive within blocks of any fast food stores. Just the aroma makes me nauseous. But I lived in Europe as a school counselor for the Department of Defense for 44 years. I could eat in Europe. I could go to restaurants. You could know that food is, the European Union has very strict rules on how animals are treated. And those farmers make a profit. They make a good living. And I am shocked at what Americans are willing to tolerate in terms of chemicals in food, and it gets worse. I'm a real litmus test for chemicals. All natural means nothing. I wouldn't touch anything that says all natural because it's not organic. It's not free of chemicals. I even can detect if something slips into organic that has chemicals in it, and I do get very ill. So, and I think Americans just do not realize what has happened. When I went to Europe 44 years ago, we did not have this problem. But once we went to big supermarkets and when we wanted food to be able to be shipped for a week or two and set on a shelf for a week or two, more and more chemicals are being poured into those foods. And so I support your speaker highly.
Frankie, you could be a lone test for chemicals, it sounds like. Food companies could benefit maybe by hiring you just to come in like the old tasters and see what kind of reaction you have. I do appreciate hearing from you, though, and I thank you for the call. I want to
thank you.
Bring another caller on here, and that's Joseph. Joseph, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you. Great show, guys.
I
wanted to say that I'm with you, Mark, as far as getting more governmental controls involved. Just quickly, I've got a 2.5-year-old, and man, I'm telling you, just taking this kid to birthday parties, there's so much cake and sugar around, and you know, you don't want to be the dad who's gonna, you know, forbid the kid from eating sugar. He's gonna have a big old fit. So, you know, we market to kids. I grew up in the 70s. Pepsi was like my daily drink. Thank God I don't have diabetes or obesity or whatever. But I just think that the government should get involved. We do it with cigarettes. We do it with alcohol. Why not do it with foods that are bad for you?
Well, let's take that example. You're familiar with Bob Lustig's work, aren't you?
Yeah. Bob's a friend of mine. Yeah.
And a friend of mine. Does he go too far in pushing, you know, sugar things labeling and all that?
You know, I just want – I want to say one thing directly in response to this. I will answer that. We all remember going to birthday parties and becoming clinically insane as a result of eating too much sugar when we were kids. And maybe that kind of thing is okay. It's the sort of pervasive presence of sugar in everything. And, you know, there's always studies that show that sugar, there's some form of sugar in 80%, 90%, or whatever of the processed food that's sold in supermarkets. So should that be reduced? Yes. Should that be labeled? Yes. I mean, there is a new FDA label, nutrition label under consideration, and they still haven't managed. It seems that they're still not going to manage to say, here's how much sugar you should limit yourself to eating every day. And that is something that we need to set a standard for that. And we need to know what percentage of sugar is contained in those products. Because, you know, most breakfast cereals, one serving, you've had your sugar for the day. You should be done. I think, you know, Rob is very energetic and passionate about this stuff. And I think his voice is really, really valuable on the sugar issue.
Got a listener named John who says, tell us what Bay Area restaurants can learn from New York or elsewhere. Where does the Bay Area food scene lag?
It is a good question. I'll tell you where it doesn't lag is in humility. but neither does New York. So, I travel a lot, and I think the best restaurants are restaurants that are run by people who really love food and understand food and have – where the chef has a terrific palate. And those are individual restaurants, and they may be here in the Bay Area where there is a high concentration, or they may be in New York, or they may be in Indianapolis. So I think, you know, the good thing about the American restaurant scene right now is that people don't feel compelled to move to New York or Brooklyn, which obviously is part of New York, but a different scene in a way. And they don't feel compelled to move to San Francisco or Oakland. They feel like they can go back home to Indianapolis or Pittsburgh or Dallas or whatever, and there will be a market for good food there. And I think that's the most positive thing that's happening in restaurants right now.
When I think of New York versus San Francisco, though, I think we probably have it all over them in Asian cuisines. But in New York—
Wrong, but okay.
Wrong. But I think you can, in New York, you get much better for, obviously, this is not your choice of food, probably. We get much better deli food. You get probably better steakhouses, things like that, than you do here.
You know, I'll go back to what I said before. It's really a case-by-case basis. New York has more because it's 10 times as big, well, 8 times as big as San Francisco. So it has more. But, if you say to me, can you get a better steak here than in New York or vice versa? I guess, you know, one would have to go research that. But in general, do you eat better meat here than there or vice versa? You probably eat better meat here because you're closer to the source for good meat.
But sometimes the meat just is cured differently here. I mean, there's all that has to be factored in, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the best deli – well, you know, I'm very disappointed in New York deli meat because I grew up eating it. So I'm comparing it to some platonic ideal from 1958.
This is not the platonic ideal.
No, but neither is New York at this point.
Here's Vignan. Good morning. Do I have your name right?
Hi. By the way, great show. I love it. I watch it all – or listen to it all the time. My question was actually in regards to your debate that you had a little bit earlier about minimum wage.
I don't know if it was a debate, Vignan. We both agree that there should be higher minimum wage, but go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, the difference in opinion, I guess. So my question's always been, and this is something I've always wondered, is The thing that apparently disproportionately affects small businesses is always the sort of argument I always hear. And I've always wondered, if small businesses tend to do relatively well or are able to stay afloat, why is there never some talk about lowering the salaries at the top to somehow compensate for the subsequent raise in minimum wage to somehow, maybe there's some sort of balance in between to do something like that? Because no one's ever talked about it like that. And I've always wondered, isn't there other ways to try to ameliorate the impact of minimum wage outside of simply saying that we just won't hire more workers?
Yeah, there may be. But Mark Bittman, how do you come down on that?
I mean, it's a terrific question. But talk about nanny state. Why don't you go try proposing that we uncompensate CEOs in order to compensate minimum wage workers? Here's one thing. I think that if...
Hold that thought, because I have to remind listeners that they're listening to Forum and that we're talking to Mark Bittman and that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, Mark, go ahead.
I've completely blanked and I'm getting out my checkbook now.
You were saying that you would talk about CEOs lowering their salaries. That would be maybe the height in many people's minds of the nanny state. But whenever we debate minimum wage, you do have people who will call and who will say, I'm barely able to survive. The rents have gone up in terms of particularly the gentrification process that we're going through here in San Francisco. I can't afford to raise as much as I'd like to the salaries.
Well, if you're saying we need our company to be at a certain level of profitability, then you have to look what can be cut in order to pay people a living wage. And needless to say, CEOs' salaries can often be cut. And if you are relying on starvation wages to stay in business, maybe you're in the wrong business. I mean, that's a very cruel thing to say, but it's not as cruel as paying people starvation wages. Is your business viable if you're relying on paying people at a rate that does not allow them to buy food?
Well, here's a question completely off of that topic, but obviously vital to somebody. Brian tweeted this. What kind of scotch did Mark Bittman have last night?
I don't know. I'll tweet it later. I was at a friend's house.
Let me thank Vignette for the call. And on to more of your calls. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning. Mark, I love your books. Michael, I think your show is great. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We are involved in agriculture at various levels. We're very interested in building sustainable soil. And so we follow great things in agriculture, including going to the International Ag Expo in Tulare County, which is this incredible show, barns and barns and barns of all kinds of information. Mm. And I have gone to composters, their booths, and asked them if they evaluate their compost after it is made. Because obviously, if I'm going to buy it and put it all over my property, I need to know that it doesn't have herbicides in it that do not break down. And one of the places where that happens is on hay, the type of herbicide that's put on hay. Now, this may not be a city problem because Roundup breaks down, but when you get those mixtures of chemicals, we have gotten compost that has obviously had manure in it, and it has killed our soil, killed our crops. So this composting issue is really something, and when I ask these vendors, so do you evaluate it? These are city vendors, right, that are recycling. They say, no,
we
don't do that.
I've heard this problem before. It is an issue.
It is really a problem, and I'm all for recycling. This is not – I just feel this is a real issue.
It is a real issue, and I thank you for bringing it to attention of our listeners, Leslie. I appreciate that. You don't have any magic bullets for her on this?
You start to get to the point where you think, okay, well, compost needs to be organic, which it can be, but that's really, really tricky. Now you're not only evaluating your final product, you're evaluating everything that comes in. So at that point, you're intentionally making – that is, you can intentionally make compost as opposed to making it from scraps, right? So you can grow whatever you want to grow organically and compost it, and that's probably at this point the only way you can get organic compost.
Leslie, good luck. Thank you for the call and the kind words. And we'll go to Hillary next. Hillary, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I just want to say, first of all, that I'm really excited that this conversation is happening, and I'm encouraged by all the other callers. And I also want to say I'm a former employee of Swantonberry Farm. so I was really excited to hear that name on the radio, and it is a wonderful place to work. First of all, I wanted to agree with Mark that I know a lot of young people who are really interested in farming. I'm a part of a community of mid-20s people who are interested in agriculture, and it is so discouraging how little support there is for that. And then I also just wanted to say that there are a lot of amazing organizations in the Bay that support workers on farms as well as sustainable produce. You already mentioned Swanton, and then Pie Ranch, also in Pescadero on the way down to Santa Cruz, is a great organization. And in North Oakland, we have Fat Beets, which is a CSA program that people can sign up for. And yeah, I just wanted to say thanks so much for shedding light on the issue. I think it's so important.
Thank you, Hillary. Good to hear from you. And Mark Bittman, I want to remind listeners, not only has a new book, A Bone to Pick, but has a series that's going to be on the air, 10-part video series, all about California matters and California agriculture and food matters, like he has been digging into in so many respects, but now he's here on our home terrain. Good to have you here in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you. Great callers. And that show launches June 8th, and thanks for having me, Michael.
Again, the book, A Bone to Pick. For all of us here at KQED, I thank you for listening. I want to remind you who is behind the scenes here. Our forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum and also find the trailer to the series that Mark has just mentioned, that I just mentioned as well. And I thank you for being a part of the program today and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.